So imagine if the 95% of the universe that we call, dark matter and dark energy, what if it isn't missing matter at all? Or some mysterious repulsive force?
What if it's literally the actual fabric of the universe itself? And we've just been doing the math wrong for, well, a century.
Exactly. Maybe
Whoa.
it's a pretty bold claim, but it forces a total reevaluation of, well, everything. From quantum mechanics all the way to black holes. Because for 100 years now, theoretical physics has basically operated on this one foundational assumption, right?
Yeah, the empty stage assumption.
Right, the idea that the universe is just this empty stage of void. And onto this stage walk the actors. So we have particles, we have light waves, fields.
And they interact on that stage.
Exactly, they interact. And so we build these completely separate mathematical rule books to describe how those actors behave. You've got general relativity for the macroscopic stage and quantum mechanics for the microscopic actors.
And as I'm sure you listening already know, those two rule books famously hate each other.
Oh, they despise each other.
Right. I mean, they mathematically break down completely when you try to combine them at high energies. Which brings us to the mission of today's deep dive. We are exploring a foundational research program that basically argues this entire setup, the separation of the stage and the actors, is a massive category
A
error.
total misconception.
Yeah, it's called the Universal Integrity Principle. Or in the literature, it's known as PIU Psi, specifically version 5.0. This was published in July 2026 by Manuel Alberto Celedón Mejía.
And we're really going to tear into the central document of this corpus today, which is titled Cómo Opera el Pleno, or, How the Plenum Operates.
Right. And the core proposition here, and it's a big one, is that there are no actors.
None.
None. There is only the stage. There is no empty space whatsoever. The author argues there is only one physical, continuous, incredibly dense substrate that spans the entire cosmos, which he calls the plenum.
The plenum. So basically, everything we observe, like a photon, an electron, a gravitational field,
Even dark energy.
right? Even dark energy. It's all simply a specific configuration or an excitation
Yeah.
of this one continuous medium.
A localized rheological behavior.
Yeah,
You know how it is.
exactly. But to really grasp the magnitude of what this theory is attempting, I think we have to talk about the current crisis in modern physics.
Oh, absolutely.
Because, I mean, I look at the standard model of particle physics. And I look at the Lambda CDM model of cosmology, and they are undisputed triumphs, observationally anyway.
Unmatched precision.
Right. We can predict the magnetic moment of the electron to like ridiculous decimal places. We map the cosmic microwave background perfectly. So someone comes along and proposes a complete foundational rewrite of reality.
You have to justify why we actually need it.
Exactly. Why fix what isn't broken? Isn't looking for a theory of everything a big cliche at this point?
Well, the crisis isn't in the precision of our measurements, right? The crisis is in our fundamental lack of explanation.
Meaning what exactly?
Meaning the standard model and Lambda CDM tell us what is happening with staggering accuracy, but they are entirely silent on why.
Oh, I see.
Take the fundamental constants: Newton's gravitational constant, G. Planck's constant, h-bar, the speed of light, the masses of all the various quarks.
Right, there's roughly, what, 20 of these numbers?
Yeah, about 20. And we measure them in a laboratory, we shrug, and we hard code them into our equations.
Or just inputs.
Exactly. If you ask the standard model why the electron has the specific mass it does, the theory has no answer. It just accepts the measured value as a given. It's fundamentally incomplete.
Okay, fair. But what about the macroscopic scale? I mean, Einstein's general relativity is incredibly elegant.
It is until it isn't. GR tells us mass curves space-time, sure, but it breaks down completely at high energies. The math literally yields infinite singularities.
Like at the center of a black hole.
Right, points of infinite density and zero volume, or at the Big Bang itself. And any physicist will tell you, infinities in physics are almost always a sign that your theory has reached the end of its useful domain.
It basically means the math is screaming, I don't know what happens next.
Exactly. And let's not forget the dark sector, which we mentioned earlier. Lambda CDM requires 95% of the universe to be made of stuff we can't even see or interact with.
Dark matter and dark energy.
Right. But as the PIU Psi documentation points out, those are essentially just placeholder terms. We fit curves to observational data, like the rotation of galaxies, and we inject these phantom variables to make the math balance out.
So they're almost like accounting tricks.
In a way, yes. And the most glaring example of this explanatory failure is the cosmological constant problem.
Oh, right, the worst prediction in physics.
Universally acknowledged as such, yes. When you use quantum field theory to try and calculate the energy density of the vacuum, which should, in theory, correspond to dark energy, the prediction is 10 to the power of 123 times larger than what we actually observe in astronomy.
A discrepancy of 123 orders of magnitude.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just absurd.
It's completely broken. And we've spent decades looking for a theory of everything to fix this. We've chased string theory, proposing, 10 or 11 dimensions.
Loop quantum gravity, trying to turn space-time into tiny discrete interlocking rings.
Right, but they almost always get hopelessly bogged down in untestable, non-falsifiable mathematics, which is exactly where PIUSCI takes a radically different methodological approach.
How so? Because proposing a universal plenum sounds a lot like proposing a theory of everything.
The author explicitly states this is not an attempt to forcefully glue general relativity and quantum mechanics together. It is not building a bridge across a canyon.
Okay.
It is demonstrating mathematically that the canyon doesn't actually exist.
Wow. Okay, so it's acting as an explanatory layer beneath them.
Exactly. It's saying, look, Einstein was right in his domain and Schrodinger was right in his domain, but they were both just looking at different effective behaviors of the exact same underlying continuous substance.
Right. But to do that, to prove that mathematically, you need a framework that is incredibly austere. Like, you can't just introduce a dozen new fundamental particles to make it work.
And he doesn't. PIUSCI describes the entire state of the universe using a single complex scalar field, just one, denoted by the Greek letter psi. And the fundamental equation is surprisingly compact. It's just psi equals s times e to the power of I times theta.
Psi equals s times e to the I theta. Okay, let's look at the mechanics of that equation. Because a complex scalar field implies two specific components at any given coordinate, right?
Yes, the modulus and the phase.
So you have the modulus s and the phase, theta. Based on standard field theory, the modulus s would represent the amplitude. So essentially how tensioned or structured the plenum is at that exact point in space.
Exactly, the structural tension.
And the phase, theta, would represent the dynamics, like the internal rotation or the spin of the medium.
That is the entire ontology right there.
Mm-hmm.
The universe possesses only those two qualities at any given point, tension and spin.
Just those two. That's incredibly minimalist.
Very. And to govern how this field evolves dynamically, PIUSCI proposes a single Lagrangian density called F1. And the author derives this Lagrangian not from, empirical guessing or fitting parameters, but from six strict physical axioms regarding the continuous nature of reality.
Okay, and this F1 Lagrangian, it breaks down into four specific mathematical terms, right? Let's dissect those. Without getting bogged down in unreadable math, obviously. What's the first term?
The first is a kinetic term, which is standard in any Lagrangian. It basically governs how the field propagates. But in PIUSCI, this establishes a strict causal structure. It defines a finite wave propagation speed limit through the medium.
Which we observe as C, the speed of light.
Exactly. Light isn't setting the speed limit of the universe. The plenum's internal elasticity is setting the speed limit, and light is just an excitation riding that maximum speed.
Right, like sound waves in water can only go so fast based on the water's density.
Perfect analogy. The second term is a potential term. This ensures the stability of the medium. It prevents the field from, spontaneously dropping to infinite negative energy. It establishes the baseline ground state of the plenum.
Making sure the universe doesn't just collapse in on itself.
Right. Now, the third term is where things get genuinely fascinating from a continuum mechanics perspective. It's a flexural term.
Flexural meaning related to bending.
Yes. It regulates the ultraviolet regime, meaning the incredibly small, highly energetic scales. Think about classical Euler-Bernoulli beam theory in engineering.
Okay, I'm not.
You can't bend a solid steel I-beam infinitely sharply, right? It has a structural stiffness. It resists.
Right. It would snap or deform.
PIUSCI applies this exact concept to the universe itself. The plenum has a flexural rigidity. You cannot concentrate energy into an infinitely sharp point without the medium resisting.
Oh, wow. So that macroscopic resistance to sharp bending, that's what we observe as microscopic quantum uncertainty.
Yes. The author mathematically derives a specific geometric coefficient for this flexural term. It's to 100, isn't it? And this isn't a fitted parameter. It emerges directly from the geometry of the continuum.
This actually reminds me a lot of advanced condensed matter physics.
Oh, absolutely.
It's conceptually akin to the Ginzburg-Landau theory or, the Gross-Piotrowski equation for superfluids. But here they're applying it relativistically to the entire cosmos itself.
Treating the universe as a macroscopic quantum condensate.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, so that's three terms. What's the fourth?
The fourth term is the Clauder quantum term. This regulates the infrared regime, the large scales. In condensed matter physics, if you have acoustic waves traveling through a solid metal block, the waves can fluctuate, but the baseline density of the metal block itself can never drop to zero.
Right, the metal has to exist to carry the wave.
The Clauder term enforces this for the universe. The modulus S must remain strictly positive. The plenum can never not exist. So there is no such thing as a true empty vacuum.
It's always there.
Always. And this brings us to a critical methodological point that really permeates the entire corpus. Theoretical physics has a bit of a bad habit, right?
Smuggling in hidden parameters.
Exactly. Smuggling in hidden parameters to force the math to match reality. But the PIU Psi corpus utilizes a very strict epistemic tagging system. Every single equation or value carries a tag.
Like what?
Well, derivato indicates a pure mathematical proof from the axioms. DLF means a strong logical deduction. And calibrato means a value is explicitly anchored to human units of measurement, like kilograms or meters.
That transparency is vital because, I mean, having an elegant Lagrangian is wonderful, but string theorists have elegant Lagrangians too, right?
Lots of them.
A theory has to actually output the universe we live in. It has to output the real numbers. So let's look at how PIU Psi derives those fundamental constants we were complaining about earlier, starting with Newton's gravitational constant, G, and Planck's constant, h-bar.
Right, because as we established in the standard model, these are inputs. We measure them and plug them in.
But under PIU Psi?
Under PIU Psi, they are inescapable structural outputs.
Okay, how?
Well, the plenum, as a physical medium, has only two substantive physical properties. It has a fundamental density, which we denote as rho sub p, and it has a microscopic coherence length, basically the scale at which its internal structure operates, denoted as L sub p. That is the entire toolkit.
Density and coherence length. So yeah. If the universe is just a dense structured fluid, how does gravity emerge from that?
Gravity is the linear response of the medium to static deformation.
Let's unpack that.
Okay, if you introduce a localized concentration of energy, which, by the way, is what mass actually is in this framework, just a localized stable knot of field tension.
A knot in the plenum.
Right. That knot modulates the macroscopic stiffness of the plenum around it. The math calculates the compliance of the medium to this deformation, and the result is an exact identity.
Which is?
G equals the causal speed limit, C squared, divided by the density times the coherence length squared.
And he just derives that from classical continuum mechanics.
Well, yes, but he doesn't just rely on that. The corpus cross-verifies this derivation using a completely independent quantum route, the Sakharov one-loop induced action.
Andrei Sakharov, the Soviet physicist.
Yes. Sakharov proposed decades ago that gravity might not be a fundamental force at all, but an induced or emergent phenomenon resulting from the quantum fluctuations of the vacuum.
Right.
PIUC crystallizes this. When you calculate the macroscopic elasticity generated by the microscopic vacuum fluctuations of the plenum, you arrive at the exact same structural requirement for G. Two entirely different physical mechanisms converge on the same value.
Okay, so that gives us macroscopic gravity. What about the microscopic quantum realm? How do we derive Planck's constant h-bar from a fluid?
We use the second component of our complex scalar field, the phase, theta. When you apply canonical quantization to the phase mode of the field, you are essentially calculating the fundamental angular inertia of the plenum's internal structure.
Angular inertia.
And the derivation yields h-bar equals the density times c times the coherence length to the fourth power.
Okay, wait, I have to stop you here.
Sure.
Because any physicist listening is going to immediately throw a red flag, the circularity trap.
Yes.
We're defining a coherence length, L sub p. But in standard physics, the Planck length is mathematically constructed by combining G, H bar, and C, right? So if we use a length scale that is basically the Planck length to derive G and H bar, aren't we just moving numbers around a whiteboard? Aren't we smuggling the answer into the premise and calling it a derivation?
It is the most vital pushback to the theory, and it's a great question. The author addresses it exhaustively in the accompanying Found Phys manuscript. The derivations are emphatically not circular.
How so?
Because the theory derives two separate mechanistic identities based on the physical properties of a continuum. One is based on static elastic compliance, which yields G. The other is based on rotational phase inertia, which yields h-bar.
Two completely different physical mechanisms.
Yes. Now, if you take those two derived equations and you mathematically eliminate the density variable between them, you get an algebraic consequence. L sub p equals the square root of h bar times g over c cubed.
Which is the exact formula for the standard Planck length.
Precisely. The standard Planck relation is an unavoidable algebraic consequence of the plenum's dual nature. Think about what this actually means physically.
Okay.
A single pair of intrinsic properties, one specific density and one specific coherence length, must satisfy both the macroscopic gravitational elasticity and the microscopic quantum inertia simultaneously.
Oh, I see. Because if the universe were just an arbitrary fluid, you would need one density to make the gravity math work and a completely different density to make the quantum math work.
Exactly. But they match. The same intrinsic properties reproduce both constants to within an error margin of less than 0.1%. The author actually subjects this to a Bayesian model selection analysis. The Bayes factor against this being a mere numerical coincidence is roughly 10 to the 11th power.
So it's basically impossible for it to be a coincidence.
It is a forced structural selection. The universe has to be exactly this way.
And there's a beautiful physical corollary to this unification, isn't there? I mean, if G and H bar both emerge from the exact same physical substrate, it automatically solves one of the messiest manual calculations in astrophysics, stellar collapse and the Chandrasekhar limit.
Yes, the Chandrasekhar limit. It's a perfect example. When a star runs out of fuel, gravity attempts to crush it. In standard physics, this is governed by general relativity and G, but the star is held up by electron degeneracy pressure, the quantum mechanical rule that prevents fermions from occupying the same state.
And that is governed by quantum mechanics and H-bar.
Right. So to find the maximum mass of a stable white dwarf, Subramanian Chandrasekhar had to manually stitch these two completely incompatible theories together.
A mathematical nightmare.
Oh, absolutely. But in PIU psi, quantum degeneracy pressure is just the flexural rigidity of the plenum we discussed earlier, and gravity is just the macroscopic elasticity of that exact same plenum.
So you don't have to stitch two theories together because it's literally just a single continuum pushing against itself.
Exactly. The mathematics natively balance the flexural rigidity against the elastic compliance, and it directly outputs the Chandrasekhar limit as roughly 1.456 solar masses. No stitching required.
That's incredibly elegant. And it naturally leads us to reconsider Einstein's legacy. Because for 50 years, the holy grail of theoretical physics has been to, quantize gravity, to find the graviton particle or to discretize space-time.
But if gravity isn't fundamental, if it's just the emergent elasticity of this medium,
then trying to quantize gravity is like trying to quantize the temperature of a cup of coffee. Right? Temperature is just an emergent property of moving molecules. A single molecule doesn't have a temperature.
Exactly. PIU psi argues that quantizing gravity is a profound category error. General relativity is not a fundamental description of the universe. It is the macroscopic rheological behavior of the plenum.
Rheological. Rheology being the study of how non-Newtonian fluids and complex materials deform and flow under stress.
Right. Think of a dilutant fluid. Like, if you have a pool filled with cornstarch and water oobleck.
Oh, yeah, the classic science experiment.
Right. If you gently push your hand into it, it flows like a liquid. But if you punch it, the sheer stress causes the particles to lock up, and it behaves like a rigid solid.
Okay.
PIU psi models the plenum with a relativistically invariant dilutant rheology. When mass moves through this medium, it modulates the stiffness. The mass naturally follows the path of least resistance through the gradient of that stiffness.
And a physicist in the 20th century, observing that path, writes down the metric tensor and calls it curved spacetime.
That's it. And the corpus mathematically proves this by deriving the geodesic equation directly from the field's variations. It completely recovers the Schwarzschild metric.
The Schwarzschild metric, that's the exact mathematical tool we use to map the gravitational field around a planet or a star,
yes.
Right?
It recovers Einstein's successes flawlessly.
But reproducing Einstein's successes is only half the battle. A new theory has to fix where the old theory fails. And general relativity fails spectacularly at singularities.
It does. In classical GR, the collapse of a massive star just doesn't stop. The math dictates that all the mass compresses into an infinitely dense point of zero volume. Space and time curvature become infinite. We know this is physically absurd, but the equations offer no mechanism to halt the collapse.
But PIU psi treats the universe as a real physical continuum. And a physical continuum has limits. You cannot compress a physical medium infinitely.
Right. Axiom A6 of the PIU psi framework establishes a strict upper bound on the density of the plenum. Because there's a hard structural limit, infinite singularities cannot mathematically or physically exist.
So what does a black hole actually look like under this framework? Like, if I fall into one, what is happening to the physics? Let's talk about the event horizon first.
Well, the first major reconceptualization is that event horizon. In standard GR, it is a point of no return caused by the geometry of space literally folding in on itself.
Right. Light can't escape the curvature.
But in PIUSCI, the event horizon is a physical sonic horizon.
A sonic horizon.
Yes. It is the boundary where the flow velocity of the medium relative to its internal structure reaches the maximum causal wave propagation speed.
Oh, I see.
It is literally Mach 1 for the plenum.
Okay, that makes sense. But what about the center? If it's not a singularity at radius r equals 0, what actually stops the collapse?
Oh, yeah. Rheology stops it. The medium reaches its maximum annihilant limit. In rheology, they call this the jamming transition, or a gent wall.
The gent wall?
Yeah. The collapsing matter compresses the plenum until it hits a maximum core density. The math actually calculates this to be roughly 2.1773 times the fundamental Planck density.
And then what?
At that exact density, the medium becomes infinitely stiff against further compression. The collapse halts entirely. You are left with a stable, ultra-dense, non-singular physical core.
So if a collapsing star cannot create a singularity because of the medium's maximum density, then we have to extrapolate that backward.
Right.
To the origin of the universe itself. The Big Bang could not have been a singularity either.
The logic demands it. Mm-hmm. And the corpus follows through. It outlines a cosmological crunch-bounce cycle. The universe compresses. The entire plenum reaches that absolute maximum density, the gent wall. And because it cannot compress further, the enormous stored elastic energy causes it to rebound.
Wow.
It is a big bounce, heavily regulated by the exact same dilatant rheology that prevents black holes from becoming singular.
Which, when you think about it, provides a fascinating new context for quantum mechanics, too. Mm. The discreteness of the quantum world, the limits on how small things can get. It's essentially just the granular texture of this medium-resisting infinite compression.
It's exactly that. And this alternate view of the universe's macroscopic behavior provides the foundation for PIUSCI's most astonishing quantitative claims. We really have to confront the dark sector now.
Let's do it. According to the current Lambda CDM model, everything we have ever seen, touched, or interacted with, every star, planet, galaxy makes up about 5% of the universe.
Right, just 5%.
27% is dark matter, which provides the gravitational scaffolding that keeps galaxies from spinning apart. And 68% is dark energy, pushing the expansion of the universe ever faster.
And as we discussed earlier, Lambda CDM treats these as free parameters. Cosmologists observe the cosmic microwave background, they measure the flatness of the universe, and they basically calculate that they need to punch in 27% and 68% to make the equations balance.
But PIUSCI refuses to use free parameters.
Refuses entirely. It derives these fractions structurally from the microscopic geometry of the medium.
Okay, let's start with dark matter. How do we get the ratio of dark matter to normal baryonic matter without measuring it first?
We have to look at the microscopic architecture of the plenum. The corpus models the smallest scales of the plenum as a crystallized bipartite diamond network. Under this framework, particles are not tiny billiard balls floating in space. They are localized topological defects in this lattice.
Like a structural flaw in a crystal that behaves like a particle.
Perfectly said. Normal baryonic matter forms a specific kind of defect, a Voronoi tetrahedron. Because of its specific geometry, this defect carries a topological winding, a topological charge.
Okay, and what does that charge do?
This winding allows it to interact with the structural waves in the lattice that we call the electromagnetic field. It absorbs and emits light.
So that's why we can see normal matter.
Right. Now, dark matter, on the other hand, is a different class of defect entirely. It forms an isotropic spherical defect. It carries a global no other charge, meaning it possesses mass and energy, but it has absolutely no topological winding.
Oh, so because it lacks that specific topological winding, it literally cannot interact with the electromagnetic field. The lattice structural waves just pass right through it.
It is perfectly transparent. It only exerts a gravitational pull by macroscopically distorting the lattice around it.
That is so conceptually clean. But how do we get the ratio?
To find the cosmological ratio of these two types of matter, the author calculates their thermodynamic weight in the primordial plasma of the early universe. This weight is proportionally tied to their respective surface areas.
The surface area of the defects?
Yes. When you mathematically divide the effective area of the dark matter sphere by the area of the baryonic tetrahedron, the result is a pure geometric constant. The square root of 3 times pi.
The square root of 3 times pi. Let me think. That calculates out to approximately 5.4414, right?
Exactly. Now look at the empirical data. The Planck satellite in 2018 provided the most precise measurements of the cosmic microwave background ever taken. They measured the ratio of dark matter to normal baryonic matter as 5.375, with an uncertainty margin of plus or minus 0.077.
So PiUSi is purely geometric derivation, relying on zero free parameters, zero manual adjustments, zero backward engineering from the data lands at 0.86 sigma from the observed data.
It is a 98.8% match. It drops squarely inside the experimental error bars.
In the realm of theoretical cosmology, deriving a fundamental cosmic fraction purely from the geometry of a microscopic lattice and having it match observational data to that precision, that is virtually unprecedented.
It is a staggering result.
Okay, so that handles the missing mass of dark matter. What about the repulsive force? Dark energy. What is pushing the universe apart in this theory?
Dark energy in PiUSi is even conceptually simpler. It is not a mysterious new quintessence fluid injected into the void. It is simply the ground state of the plenum itself.
So it's just the baseline inherent tension of the medium when it is perfectly relaxed.
Exactly. The tension of the canvas itself. Because it is the fundamental state of a continuous relativistic medium, its equation of state, which cosmologists denote with the letter W, is exactly negative 1.
W equals negative 1, meaning its energy density remains perfectly constant even as the universe expands.
Right, which exerts a steady, uniform negative pressure on the cosmos.
Okay, I have to challenge this, though. Based on very recent observational data, the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument, DSI, they released their data release 2 recently, DR2, and it sent shockwaves through the physics community.
Ah, yes, the DR2 data.
Because their data suggested that dark energy might be dynamic, that the equation of state might be evolving over time, a mathematical parameterization cosmologists call W0 wah-wah. Doesn't this new data immediately falsify PiUSi's prediction of a strict, unyielding W equals negative 1?
It's a critical point of confrontation, and the author doesn't shy away from it. He actually published an entire supplemental analysis dedicated specifically to the DSI DR2 data.
But really, what does he say?
The corpus argues that the DSI signal for dynamic dark energy is entirely an artifact of parameterization.
Explain that. How does a parameterization artifact create a false physical signal?
When cosmologists analyze massive data sets like DESI, they don't just look at raw numbers. They have to feed the raw data through a mathematical template to interpret it. The Lambda CDM model assumes certain behaviors.
Right.
If the universe truly is a plenum with a strictly constant ground state of W equals negative 1, but you force your data analysis through a WWAH mathematical mold.
A template designed to look for evolution over time.
Right. That template will mathematically bend and twist to absorb subtle nonlinearities in the data. This twisting creates a false statistical signal of dynamics that isn't actually physical.
Oh, I see. It's like wearing red tinted glasses and concluding the entire universe is pink. The tint is in your instrument, not the reality.
That's a great way to put it. The author demonstrates that when you strip away the Lambda CDM assumptions and look at the raw model-independent observables from DSI, the actual physical distances to galaxies and the raw acoustic angles, the tension disappears completely. The data perfectly supports a static W equals negative 1.
So PiUSi's is essentially making a bold prediction here.
Very bold. It predicts that as more data comes in from DZSI or DR3 and beyond, and as the data is analyzed without those baked-in assumptions, the signal for dynamic dark energy will entirely dissolve.
That will be fascinating to watch. Now, while we are untangling cosmology, we have to revisit the 10 to the power of 123 problem, the cosmological constant problem we mentioned at the start. How does a single continuous medium explain why our quantum math is wrong by 123 orders of magnitude?
It solves it by realizing we've been asking the wrong question for 70 years. Physicists have treated the cosmological constant and the Hubble constant, H-naught, as fundamental, unchanging properties of nature.
Right.
And because they view them as fundamental constants, they are totally baffled as to why they require such absurd levels of fine-tuning to avoid crushing the universe or ripping it apart instantly.
The entropic principle is usually invoked here, right? Like, we just happen to live in the one universe in the multiverse where the numbers randomly canceled out to 120 decimal places,
mm-hmm.
which always felt to me like an intellectual surrender.
It absolutely is. But PiUSI reframes the ontology entirely. The theory dictates that the Hubble constant is not a fundamental constant at all. It is a positional quantity.
A positional quantity. Like a coordinate.
Like the time on a clock. In PiUSI, the value of the cosmological constant is intrinsically and dynamically linked to the age of the universe. The number 10 to the negative 123 is not a fine-tuning error between competing quantum forces. It mathematically represents the age of the universe measured in fundamental Planck ticks.
Wait, really? So as the universe ages, that number is slowly, imperceptibly changing.
Exactly. The mathematics show that the observed cosmological constant is inversely proportional to the square of the age of the universe in fundamental units. It is literally like looking at a clock on the wall that says 1200 and agonizing over the question, why is the universe so exquisitely fine-tuned to produce the number 12?
Oh, man.
It isn't fine-tuned. It's just noon. In an hour, it will be 1.00.
That is staggering. It takes this messy, convoluted crisis that has spawned, what, thousands of research papers and just untangles it. It replaces a fine-tuning paradox with a simple statement of what time it is in the cosmic evolution.
It's a very elegant paradigm shift. However, a beautiful explanation of past mysteries is not enough, right? A scientific theory must risk its neck.
It has to offer testable, falsifiable predictions that differentiate it from the existing paradigm. Because if PiUSI only explained what we already know, it would be philosophy, not physics.
Exactly.
So how do we actually prove the plenum exists using today's or tomorrow's telescopes? Where does the theory put itself on the line?
The scientific integrity of the corpus is highly evident here. The author explicitly details predictions that lambda CDM and standard quantum field theory simply did not make. The most immediate test lies in the behavior of gravitational waves.
Gravitational waves. Okay, we've been detecting those from colliding black holes using LIGO for a few years now.
Yeah.
What is PiUSI looking for?
Well, because the plenum is a physical medium with a Wright and Cosmic Explorer, they will possess the required sensitivity. If they measure high-frequency gravitational waves and find zero dispersion, the flexural framework of PiUSI is in severe trouble.
That is a clear line in the sand. What about the origin of the universe? We talked about the Big Bounce earlier. Does that leave a different signature than the standard inflationary Big Bang?
It absolutely does, and it's testable in the cosmic microwave background. Standard inflation predicts a specific spectrum of primordial gravitational waves. PiUSI's dilatant bounce mechanism predicts a distinct asymmetry in the scalar to tensor ratio of the CMB.
Along with a specific red to blue tilt transition in the primordial spectrum, if I recall from the notes.
Yes, exactly.
Meaning the distribution of hot and cold spots in the background radiation of the universe will lean in a specific direction that inflation cannot account for.
Correct. And next-generation CMB observatories, specifically CMBS-4 and the Lightbird satellite, are being engineered to measure these exact polarizations.
And it's not just cosmology, right? There are particle physics predictions as well.
Oh, yeah. Based on the geometry of those topological defects we discussed, the spheres and tetrahedrons, the theory predicts a rotational hadronic tower.
What's that?
It's a specific spectrum of resonance states for particles. It also predicts a specific vortex separation inside the baryon that is exactly equal to the baryon radius. These are hard, quantitative geometric ratios that future high-luminosity particle accelerators can probe directly.
The transparency of the author in this regard is really remarkable, because the corpus doesn't hide its limitations. There are explicit sections outlining, you know, cabos de teoria, theory loose ends, and cabos de confrontation loose ends.
It's refreshing. The author openly lists exactly where the mathematics are still incomplete, like deriving the exact mass of the electron from the lattice dynamics. And he states exactly where third-party observational data is needed to confirm the derivations.
It even goes a step further in open science. The author provides the underlying Python scripts alongside the paper. Like there's one called verificarpiu.py.
Right. So the scientific community doesn't have to take the author's word for the complex derivations. Anyone can run the code, check the exact algebraic steps, and verify the model selection statistics.
It is proposing a rigorous, transparent research program, not a finished dogmatic truth.
Exactly.
So if we synthesize the immense scope of what we've covered today, the sheer economy of PiUSI is the defining takeaway for me. By postulating just one continuous medium, the plenum, and describing its tension and dynamics with a single complex scalar field, the framework mathematically derives the forces of gravity.
The rules of quantum mechanics.
Right, the fundamental constants of nature, and the exact ratios of the dark sector.
It removes the need for 20 plus arbitrary numerical inputs. It replaces them with the geometry and the rheology of a physical continuum. It provides the why that standard models leave blank.
Why is the ratio of dark matter to normal matter 5.4?
Because of the geometric surface area difference between a sphere and a tetrahedron in a bipartite diamond lattice.
Why does gravity curve spacetime?
Because mass modulates the elastic compliance of the underlying medium.
It is a monumental ontological shift. And, you know, it brings to mind a genuinely profound historical reflection highlighted in the text about Max Planck, the founding father of quantum mechanics.
Oh, yes. That's a fascinating piece of history. We are taught in every introductory physics class that Max Planck discovered the revolutionary idea that energy comes in discrete, indivisible packets rather than a continuous flow.
But historically, Planck himself resisted this interpretation deeply, didn't he?
He did. He spent over a decade trying to eliminate the quantum discontinuity from his own theories.
He viewed the quantum merely as a phenomenological bridge, like an ugly mathematical trick that was just necessary to fix his equations for blackbody radiation.
Right. He didn't believe it was a fundamental truth about reality. His intuition, right up until the end of his life, was that nature must be continuous.
And PIU Psi essentially vindicates Planck's intuition. It suggests that the universe is a continuum after all. The plenum. The discreteness of quantum mechanics, the packets of energy, those seemingly isolated particles, they aren't fundamental.
They're just the physical resolution limit of the plenum's internal structure. It's the grain of the universe.
You look closely at a digital photograph, you see discrete square pixels. But the scene, it captured the sunlight, the landscape was continuous. Quantum mechanics is just the physics of the pixels. PIU Psi is the physics of the canvas itself.
That's a beautiful way to phrase it.
So the next time you look up at the night sky or, you know, just feel the weight of gravity holding your feet to the ground, consider the stage. Are you interacting with a dozen different invisible forces and fundamental particles acting out a play in an empty void? Or are you, and everything around you, just one single vibrating continuum wearing infinitely many disguises?
It completely changes how you conceptualize your own physical existence in the cosmos.
It certainly does. Thank you for taking this deep dive with us.